that, I will call to order this remote hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. It is Tuesday, March 29th, 2022, and we are holding this committee remotely per Rule 10.01. Michaela, please go ahead with the roll.
Beckerson?
Present.
Mueller?
Present.
Scott?
Here.
Feist?
Present.
Frazier?
Present.
Grossel? Her. Collins.
Present.
Johnson.
Present.
Liebling.
Present.
Long.
Present.
Mortensen. Novotny.
Novotny present.
Barr. Robbins.
Present.
Vang. Zhang.
Present.
All right. A quorum is present. Second deadline week, so I know people are bouncing around to different committees. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Scott, do I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 24th, 2022?
You do, Madam Chair. So moved.
Thank you. Any discussion to the minutes? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Another busy day in committee, lots of things moving here in second deadline week, so we'll get right to it. First bill on the agenda is Representative Agbaje's bill, House File 4269. I will move House File 4269 be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Agbaje, the bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for taking the time to hear House File 4269. Which would create a pilot program to provide targeted down payment assistance to first-generation homebuyers. The purpose of the bill is to open more opportunities for home ownership by lowering barriers to down payment assistance that are present in current programs. The program as outlined in this bill is aimed at people who do not own a home and do not have a parent who has owned a home. By ensuring that such funds go to those who do not have access to generational wealth, we can support families who desire home ownership. My presentation to the committee today will focus on the contents of Subdivision 7. Subdivision 7, which can be found on page 3, lines 1 through 6, provides for creditor immunity for good faith reliance on borrower self-attestations. The language, which was included at the suggestion of lenders, ensures that lenders will not be held liable or have to pay back a government entity if the borrower gave false information about their eligibility for the program to receive down payment assistance. We hope this is helpful to allow more lenders to partner in this program and provide much needed assistance to those who otherwise would not have access to it. The advocates for this bill are a diverse coalition led by Minnesota Home Ownership Center, Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, and the Minnesota Realtors, and of course has support from many nonprofits, local units of government, and business trade associations. I believe there's a handout in your packets that includes a fuller list of the supporting organizations as well as the need for this type of down payment assistance. Finally, the bill is also supported by the Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity, whose membership includes more than 70 businesses and many of Minnesota's largest employers, such as 3M, Target, General Mills, Best Buy, Cargill, and dozens of others. A number of stakeholders are really working hard to make sure that we are providing stable housing for more Minnesotans. And I ask for the committee's support in moving this bill forward. I'm available for questions, and I also have Paul Eager from Minnesota Realtors and Julie Guggen with me from the Minnesota Home Ownership Center to answer questions as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Paul Eager, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair.
My name is Paul Egger, Senior Vice President with the Minnesota Realtors, and Representative Agbaje did a great job describing the bill. I'm just here in case there are any questions, since I know your committee has a packed agenda, and just we support the bill, and thanks for your time today.
All right. Is Ms. Guggen also just available for questions, Representative Agbaji? All right, yes. Got it. Thank you. And really appreciate you understanding where we are in second deadline week. So with that, members, we will move ahead to discussion. And we'll just remind folks that the question before us today is on subdivision 7, which relates to the liability question, and that that's in the purview of our committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I think it's related to this point. Representative Agbaji, or maybe somebody else, one of your testifiers could answer the question. I thought we got away from attestations of income or stated income loans. And so speak to that issue, because it seems in this bill that you're going to take just attestations. Are you going to have backup documents to that? I don't want the lenders to be liable for something that we're giving them permission to do and just base a loan on stated income, and then something happens and that loan is defaulted on. So if you could explain that, that'd be great.
Representative Agbaji.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. That's a great question. So their only self-attestation is to their eligibility. The eligibility focuses on whether they have owned a home in the past 3 years, whether they have a parent or a guardian who has owned a home or at the time of their death owned a home. And it's really just meant to be about their eligibility into the program in that respect. I think the lenders would still do their due diligence on their other financial qualifications, but it's really about the ability to apply for this program. And then this clause is really meant to make sure that they actually would not be held liable, so they can just go on the good faith of people, because we know that most people who don't have access to these programs, it's really hard for them to find the assistance that they need and the capital that they need to get into home ownership. And we want to make sure that it's as open to as many people as possible, but that lenders also don't get burned in the process. And I saw Mr. Egger is available to add more, I think.
Mr. Egger, although I think it's pretty clear if you go to lines 3.5 and 3.6 that it's a good faith reliance on borrower attestations of eligibility required by this section or regulation. I think it's pretty clear, but I don't know if you want to add anything else, Mr. Egger.
No, Madam Chair, I think you and Representative Agbaji did a good job of covering what this provision is trying to do.
All right. Follow-up, Representative Scott.
No, Madam Chair, I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion to the bill? All right. Not seeing any other hands. Representative Agbaji, any closing comments?
Nope, just asking for the committee support. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Agbaji. I'm glad we can move this forward. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4269 be referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Eckerfin?
Aye.
Muller?
Aye.
Scott?
Abstain.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel? Excused. Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson? Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
No.
Barr?
Aye.
Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Jung?
Aye.
That is 11 ayes and 3 nays.
Great. The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Agbaji, and our testifiers this morning. Moving along to our next bill, the next bill on our agenda is House File 3845, Representative Hansen J. Bill, I will move House File 3845 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Hansen, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear about this important issue. HF 3845 seeks to create an office for a youth foster ombudsperson. Children in foster care face critically important issues, and they deserve to be served and protected like all the other children in our state. Youth in foster care do not always have a resource or an avenue for intervention when they face abuse or neglect at the hands of our very own child protection systems. Navigating the foster care system alone is a challenging task, and without the appropriate tools and advocates, we will continue to allow the common cycles of hurt and trauma that we are seeing in our communities today. As some of you may know, I've presented other bills, including to this committee, about some of the existing challenges in the child welfare system. And in this space and for this bill, I do want to just repeat a few of the statistics that we talked about before and why focusing on this issue is so imperative. In Minnesota in 2020, American Indian and Indigenous children were 16.4 times more likely than white children to be removed from their homes. African American and Black children were 2.4 times more likely to be removed from their homes than white children. And children of two or more races faced the 6.8 times more likely. The disparities for Indigenous kids and families are some of the worst in the nation, and too many of us see too many similarities between today's child protection system and boarding schools of the past. The system's riddled by bias, and that we're working to address this with other bills, but this office is just one of the other tools in the toolbox on this initiative. The office aims to provide oversight for the systems that are tasked with protecting Minnesota's children from harm and to create a pathway to adequately track the issues affecting young people in foster care in Minnesota. As it stands today, there are no organizations or entities that track complaints or common concerns that arise for the youth in foster care. And without this information, we are left without the critically important data that we value to inform necessary changes. While we, of course, have some data that gives us glimpses into the system's overall efficacy, the lack of more data means that we're lacking that ability to make data-informed decisions as we work to protect kids and implement meaningful changes that they need. Establishing this office will promote equity and equal opportunity for more of the foster population. And although this will not address all of the needs for youth in foster care, this office will make sure that more youth in foster care have more access to critical resources and that they'll have an advocate to help them resolve these issues. And it will give more visibility to the need for change as called by for this by this community. Members, by establishing an ombudsperson's office for fosters, we're creating an organizational structure that will create positive change. It will allow for more capacity to do independent investigations and track areas where significant interventions are needed. This office would positively affect the child welfare system by increasingly addressing the intersecting issues that youth often face in foster care, like housing and homelessness, substance use and abuse, and violence. We are finalizing an amendment to move this under the Office of Administration. We're changing the references from DHS in the bill to some local agencies and adding a guardian ad litem to the board. And this is moving forward in the Senate with bipartisan support in both bodies. I'd like to thank my co-authors on this. And most importantly, I'd like to thank my testifiers and the community who have stepped up to advocate for youth in foster care. This has been a long and collaborative effort, and it really is something that we should all be proud of. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. We have on the list Wong Murphy. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Wong Murphy. I'm the founder of a nonprofit called Foster Advocates. It's not just our name, it's what we do. We foster advocacy with young people who have been impacted by foster care. I founded this org in 2018 based on the audacious idea that child welfare systems change could and should be led by the people most impacted. Since then, we engaged with fosters across the state. However, I must apologize because while I deeply wish this was a chance for me to tell you how great we are doing as a state, I'm sorry to inform all of you that we are not, not by any reasonable measure of success. Upon reaching our 21st birthday, at a time when most of our peers are celebrating, fosters face a deep stability cliff as they lose financial and social support networks provided by the state. It is no wonder that when within a year of aging out of care, often at 18, 20 to 40% of fosters experience homelessness, with half to two-thirds experiencing homelessness within the first 4 years of aging out. In fact, experience in foster care is one of the most predictable factors for homelessness. A recent survey of fosters aged 18 to 21 in the seven metro counties found that 79% had experienced homelessness. When families are not safe or good places for children to be, the government intervenes. But who intervenes when it is the government that is causing the abuse? This begs just a really basic question. Who is watching the watchers? Currently, no one. Children entrusted to our care must face the challenges of life on their own upon aging out. They shouldn't have to face the foster care system alone with no one to call for help. It doesn't have to be this way. We can do better by our young people. We must do better. Creating more opportunity for the Ombuds Office to lead meaningful change and improve systemic issues plaguing the child welfare system in Minnesota will go a long ways to helping young people. This will have a trickle-down effect for the state's child welfare system by anticipating and fixing issues that otherwise may lead to endangerment of foster youth, as well as curbing any potential lawsuits by former and current foster youth. Creating an advisory board for youth and advocates will give space for youth with lived experience of foster care to have a voice in the system. The increased oversight from the advisory board will help the office to better define its objectives and evaluate its impact. These are our children. They became ours when we separated them from their families. We owe them a duty of care just as strong as we do for the children in our very own homes. The fundamental truth is that children are children, and they have an expectation, or should have an expectation, that adults will take care of them. But I've repeatedly seen at the personal level, and now at the systems level, this just isn't happening. So it's my sincerest hope that those of you in power or who are in a position to make a difference in this matter deeply reflect on our moral responsibility and the cost of our continued indifference. Please support the creation of an Office of the Ombudsperson for Fosters. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. I don't have any other testifiers on the list, so we will move on to member discussion. Members, any? All right. Representative Scott.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I certainly understand why this is, you want to get this program set up. That said, you're going to be, you're, one of the reasons you're in this committee is for the data pieces. And so one of my concerns is that you're going to be handling, that office is going to be handling some really sensitive data, medical information about the kids, and other information from the courts about these kids. And, you know, these are juveniles. Those cases are usually sealed. And so I'm curious as to how you're going to be protecting that data. Is this information going into a database? Are you getting it electronically submitted to your office, or if you could give me the lay of the land on that, that'd be helpful.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. This is a new office, and so part of what will be established will be the protection of that data. I have no doubt that the board and those who will be setting up this office have the same intentions as you have. You've raised a great profile about this over this year to talk about the need to protect data. And I think anybody watching, you know, stuff that's going on in the Minnesota legislature would be amiss if they have missed your conversations about this, Representative Scott. So I think that's a really important piece. To know that we have resources like yourself and others who can help with that. We have other offices who are recently set up that I know Mr. Murphy and others who will remain closely integrated with this will do what is necessary to protect the data for these children, because a lot of things for these kids haven't been protected, right? If we continue to just fail on protections, we're not doing the full responsibility of this office. And so I know that in the conversations I've had with a number of folks on both sides of the aisle, that this data piece is going to be very important and protected as much as possible. And Mr. Murphy, I will defer to you if you have anything else you'd like to add to that as well.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. The only thing I would add is that data systems are incredibly important for young people, and securing them is incredibly serious. In DHS, often the data system that's used for PROSTRUTH is something called SSI. It is a very secure federal data system, and that is one that the Ombuds Office will then also be working through. It's one that houses all of foster youth's data for the state, and that's something that the Ombuds Office will also need to have access to, but one that is confidential. I certainly take data seriously as someone that was in foster care, and often we have seen young people whose data was not secured by their bio families or by foster families suffer the consequences of that. This is an office that we will hold accountable to make sure that they have those data systems, and I would love to work with you in partnership, Representative Scott, to secure that even further. We take that very seriously, and any recommendations that you have to support that, we would love to work in partnership to make sure that those are systems that are in place. Thank you.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks for those answers. And I appreciate your support of and wanting to keep the data secure. Mr. Murphy, the SSI system, I don't serve on Health and Human Services at all. I've avoided it like the plague. But can you tell me if this SSI server, data system that you mentioned, are audit trails created when that data is shared, if you know the answer to that?
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. I do not, because the system's so secure, I don't have any access to it. It's something that only workers that need to have a relevant case, like the only people that have access are the folks who have to, right? There's no reason that I need that access to a specific young person's data, so therefore I can't even request that data. But it's something that this ombudsperson will have access to on an individual basis when they make a request and as needed.
Representative Scott. And I'm sure there is an answer to that question. So we will, and I see Representative Hansen nodding, so I'm sure we can get an answer for the committee. Just, it doesn't seem like anyone knows the answer right in this moment. Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I won't be supporting the bill today because I don't feel like this is tight enough information. As you said, these kids have already been through a lot. The last thing they need out there in the public domain in some way is for someone to find out about abuse, whether that's physical, sexual, anything. This has to be one of the tightest ships to me in state government is information about juveniles that have been through the ringer in life. So I would really like to see that tightened up and have language in the bill that talks about audit trails, that talks about role-based access, so that we can put belt and suspenders on this. And I know you're well-intended. That's not the question here at all, but I think we need to have that securely written in the bill. Thank you.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker, Finn, Representative Hansen, I appreciate the work you're trying to do for foster care. We are very short on number of foster parents, not just for long-term, but also for short-term. And all the rules and regulations is making it even harder to find people willing to do this. There's some great people out there doing the foster care, but with some of the rules and regulations that we already have in place, it's made it even more difficult to get them. I do have some concerns on this bill. Representative Scott brought some of them up. Generally, when we do something like this, we put the parameters in and the audit trails in to protect that data right in the bill, and it appears to be they're missing in this part of it. Also, I have concerns on the ombudsperson, that part of it. Especially when they are not required to testify in court, because their reports are going to be used in court. And in order to, with the chain of evidence and everything like that, they have to attest that their reports are true and accurate in court. Without doing that, it could if the reports turned out to be false and false statements by the omnibus person, they could not be held accountable, which is a serious offense. And any accuser has a right to face his, or any, every person has a right in our Constitution to face their accusers. So I think that's an area that needs to be fixed. Until that's taken care of, I cannot support this bill.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I saw this bill, I was reminded of the Ombudsperson for Corrections that we created at the legislature in 2019, and I just looked up the data provision for that office. And this really mirrors exactly what we did with that office. So I think that that is a really good model. And just a reminder that, and I know people on this committee know, but Chapter 13 itself has a lot of protections for data written into it and what the responsible authority is supposed to do with that data, what happens if there's a breach of that data. I'm not quite sure what Representative Johnson was referring to as far as some court proceedings, but I can't quite remember the provision, but I think there's a provision in there about a court being able to order in certain circumstances. Court does some sort of balancing test depending on the situation of the case. So I think a lot of these protections are already in other provisions of Chapter 13, and I'm very comfortable supporting the bill as it is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen, any response to the comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add that when we're trying to do something new to protect kids, we do have to look, like Representative Mueller said, at some of the other pieces that are there. I think also knowing just a little bit of the background of this bill, I just want to take a second to thank Representative Schumacher for being at the table to draft this bill in the first place, that he gave this a very strong vetting to a point where, so he felt comfortable supporting this as well. And we have support across the aisle from Senators Housley and Abler as well, who have looked into some of the points that we've heard questioned today. And so this bill has gone through the due diligence of what we in this body say is a bipartisan review and effort. And so I just wanted to put that out there just as a confirmation for folks who may be on the fence about which way to go with this. I also just think that kids deserve this protection. You heard in my comments about how dangerous this our existing system is for too many kids. And this is establishing a board who will oversee the integrity, the data, making sure that we're doing this right. And so I just wanted to put those few things out there, and I'll turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill forward. I just want to speak super briefly about my own experience with the foster care system, which is not for me personally, but with a number of my friends that have gone through this. And I want to address a little bit of the concern about the data privacy, because I can confirm for you that there is no data privacy currently. You know, there might be something in place, but nobody is following it. I have heard foster parents talk about what their kids have been through openly, you know, and with almost anybody. And it is, especially as a child, as another child talking about it in front of me, it was very uncomfortable. And I have to say, you know, having any sort of recourse other than what we have currently is needed, because I have heard horror stories about what happens to these foster kids and what happens in these foster homes. And obviously not everybody, a lot of folks are really well-meaning, but the reality is when these things happen, there's nowhere to turn. I used to manage pro bono programs, and there were a number of people who volunteered with the Children's Law Center. And when it rose to the level that the Children's Law Center had to intervene, I mean, that was literally child labor, like putting kids to work in businesses and not letting them go to school because of it. And that's how high it had to get before they were able to intervene. And so I really think that there is a lot of middle ground here that we could address with this bill and with this new office. And for that reason, I'm very much in favor of it. So thank you so much. this opportunity.
All right. Representative Scott, and then we'll move on to the vote. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me speak again. And Representative Hollins, I don't know, I understand what you're saying, and I don't know enough about the foster system right now to know if that data is currently classified, if foster parents have to sign something saying they won't disclose stuff about these kids. I don't know how that works, but I certainly am willing to look into that. But the other issue I wanted to bring up, and Representative Mueller brought up, you know, this is patterned after the corrections ombudsman. And I just want to, for the record, state that I had issues with the data, and so did others on that bill. So just because it's patterned after something that's in current law doesn't mean that it's acceptable and right. So thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Vice Chair Mueller, your hand's still up. Do you have another question? Or okay. All right. Representative Hansen, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I, again, just want to applaud the bipartisan effort that went into build this bill from the ground up, and that the work that's taken to move it through both bodies in the legislature. I'm just really proud of everybody, and we're making the changes that folks are asking for, and thanks again to our testifiers so much.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3845 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn.
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Brazier?
Aye.
Grossel? Excused. Her? Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Vang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 9 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, the motion prevails, and the bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen and Mr. Murphy. Moving right along to the next bill, we've got House File 2711, Representative Wasloick bill. I will move House File 2711 be referred to the General Register. Representative Wasloick, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2711 provides for a notice to be given by homeowners associations to homeowners of their rights and responsibilities when a fine or assessment is imposed. It also informs the homeowner of their right under existing law to dispute the charge and have a hearing before the board. Anyone who is a member of an HOA knows that, you know, homeowners are already given and expected to read documents like the declaration, the bylaws, and the rules and regulations of the association when they become homeowners. But the reality is that many homeowners do not realize that assessments and fines become liens by operation of law. It's often a surprise to homeowners when they realize that even if they've paid their mortgage off, the association can initiate a foreclosure and the homeowner can lose their unit. So this notice would tell the homeowner the reason for the fine or assessment, the specific bylaw or rule that was allegedly violated, the right to dispute the fine or assessment and have a hearing, that if the assessment or fine goes unpaid, it could lead to foreclosure, and then provides a referral to the homeownership's center as a resource to help resolve the dispute and avoid foreclosure. I do want to thank the Community Association Institute, which represents homeowners associations, for working collaboratively with all the stakeholders to come together on this language that is before you today. It is an agreement that has been made with all the stakeholders working on this issue. Although there are other more complex issues that need to be addressed in this area, this bill is an important step forward that we hope will better inform homeowners and hopefully help avert unnecessary foreclosures. And there are a couple testifiers here to talk a little bit more about this.
All right. First on the list, I have Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Ellard with Legal Aid, and I just want to thank Representative Wasluwick for bringing this forward, and also thank the Community Association Institute, and in particular Patrick Hines for working with us so closely to get to where we are today. All I want to say is that Legal Aid has represented a number of clients in these situations, and as Representative Wasluwick said, we look forward to working with the Institute for in the future to find new ways to prevent foreclosure and keep the HOAs viable. But this is a really good first step, and we appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. I see we also have Patrick Hines is available for questions if members have them. So with that, we will move on to member discussion. Members, any questions, discussion to the bill? All right. Doesn't look like anyone has any questions. Representative Wasluwick, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill, and I just hope that folks can support it. It's an important step that we can take to make sure folks who are in HOAs have the information that they need when it comes to these fines and assessments, and know are more informed about the consequences, and that they can move forward with those resolutions with the HOAs and understand what's happening and what the penalties might be. So appreciate the time to present in committee today, and thanks for supporting.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2711 be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Muller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel excused. Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Avotney?
Avotney, aye.
Rock, Farr?
Farr, aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and zero nays.
All right. The motion prevails, and the bill is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Wasluwick. Members, the next bill on our agenda is House File 3605, a Representative Rasmussen bill. House File 3605 fell victim to time and is not actually in our possession, but given that we are short for time this week and it is second deadline week, we're going to have Representative Rasmussen go ahead and present his bill and take the testimony, and then we will formally move it on Thursday when the bill is actually in our committee's possession. So I think we're all on board with wanting to move this forward, and that's how we're going to move forward today. But for the record, I will not be moving it because we don't actually have it. So Representative Rasmussen, welcome to our committee, and please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very much appreciate the time to talk about House File 3605 today. This bill is relating to broadband and was heard in Chair Pawlowski's committee last week. There is a data sharing provision that necessitates a stop in this committee. The line extension bill contains a provision that allows consumers to voluntarily report to the Office of Broadband Development through a web portal that broadband service is unavailable at the physical address of their residence or business, along with any other information OBD needs to ensure the broadband line extension program functions effectively. The bill further requires OBD to send broadband service providers a list of addresses submitted to the portal, along with any additional information they need to operate the line extension program. Broadband providers may then notify the Office of Broadband if they currently serve any of the addresses submitted to the portal. If an address is served, OBD must provide those residents the contact information for the service providers offering service to those addresses, along with the contact information about broadband affordability programs. For the addresses that are unserved, broadband service providers bid in a reverse auction process for the opportunity to serve those customers for the least amount of state subsidy. The reason the bill is in the possession of this committee is to ensure the data sharing mechanisms called for in the bill don't raise any issues under the Minnesota Government Data Practices 2 Act. If enacted, OBD will need to provide a warning to the for the collection of data through the line extension portal. The warning will inform residents that the data collected will be used to operate the line extension program and will be provided to broadband service providers. The Office of Broadband will also be required to treat the portal data in its possession as private data on individuals protected from public disclosure by the state. With that, Madam Chair, just wanted to say that this bill has broad bipartisan support, 17 authors in the House, a number of letters that have been submitted in support of this bill from various organizations, and just appreciate the time to discuss this bill, and we'll take any questions that members might have.
All right. And so just as a reminder, members, we will not have further discussion of this on this bill when we move it on Thursday. So this is your chance to weigh in if you would like to. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Have we killed a bill in this committee yet this year, Madam Chair? I'm just teasing. I wouldn't do that to Representative Rasmussen. No, thanks for reaching out to me prior to this, Representative Rasmussen, and people are voluntarily giving this their addresses into this portal. So I think the bill is good. It's using existing funds and that broadband, border-to-border broadband fund. And so, we're constantly learning that there are issues with broadband and weaknesses throughout our state where people don't have access. So if this is going to help in that regard, I support it. Thank you.
All right. And Representative Scott, I am a hunter, but I am not really interested in killing legislation if that doesn't need to happen. So I think we're on the board with, I think, the most bills passed off the House floor so far this year. So that's we're getting the work done here in Judiciary Committee. Any further discussion to Representative Rasmussen's bill? All right. There's no formal laying over anything to do because I don't have the virtual bill in my possession. But Representative Rasmussen, I know we did have a couple people on hand if there were additional questions. I will just remind members that there is a DE, and that was properly, we did post all of that for folks to review ahead of this committee. But for the record, there is a DE, so we will be also be moving that when we have the bill in our possession, and just encourage members to take a look at that and reach out. I know Representative Rasmussen is pretty good at working his bills. So if you have any questions, please reach out to the chief author so that we can move expeditiously when we're back on this bill on Thursday. Any closing comments, Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the time. And thank you, Representative Scott, for talking me through the data section and making sure that it complies with the standards of this committee and of the state. And just appreciate members' support of the bill. And if you have any questions or would like to join as a co-author, please reach out.
All right. Thank you for being with us this morning. And again, we'll be back on this on Thursday. So moving along to the next bill we're going to bring up today is House File 3395. This is a Representative Nelson bill. I understand Representative Nelson has joined the Zoom. Representative Nelson, I will move your bill, House File 3395. You referred to Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. A few years back, Representative Lyndon Carlson reinstituted the Public Employee Relations Board, commonly known as the PERB. This bill was gotten rid of many years ago and was brought back. This is a way for labor unions and the public employers to get together and hash out their issues that they might have. Currently, if they have an issue, if they have a grievance, they have to go to court to get these settled. By doing this, it would save money not only for the state, but also for the labor unions and the members that have issues that bring brought back up. But it's been on the board or on our books for a few years, but we've never funded it. And this bill basically goes to funding it and setting up a funding mechanism for it so they can go forward and they can investigate these complaints and issues that are and get them settled through mediation and without having to go to court to get them settled. The reason we're here in front of you today is there's as my understanding, is there some data provisions that are in here. And the provisions in the bill, which is the section 2 of the bill, it adds new provisions, making the data that's maintained by the PERB board related to unfair labor practices, complaints, or appeals protected, non-public, or confidential data under the MGDPA that may be subject to a protective order. It makes other types of data related to the PERB public data, including the filing of the date of unfair labor charge, the status of an unfair labor charge, names and job classes of the charging and charged parties, alleged provisions of the law violated, complaint issued by the PERB, and all data in the complaint, full and complete record of any evidentiary hearing on the charge, and recommended decisions and orders. Exceptions to recommended decision order would be briefs filed with the PERB and decisions and orders filed by the PERB. It also provides that individuals have access to their own statements that they made to the PERB and allows the PERB to grant access to protected non-public or confidential data if it would aid in implementing chart of chapters 179 and 179A. And that is why it's in front of the committee, and I guess I'll take any questions. I think we have a couple testifiers here. So I'll let my testifier speak, and then hopefully we can answer any questions.
Great. First testifier I have on the list is Meg Luger-Nicolai. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Good morning. My name is Meg Luger-Nicolai. I am the union representative on the Public Employment Labor Relations Board. And until July 1st of last year, the PERB was open for business, which meant helping to resolve disputes in a cost-effective and efficient way possible while avoiding, you know, adding additional burdens to our courts. But we're kind of the Brigadoon of agencies in Minnesota. And so we existed and then we didn't. And we're hoping to snap back into existence. And that's what the language before this committee would be doing. So as you're likely aware, we review unfair labor practice charges, and that means we determine whether or not they have merit. And if they do, they move on to an administrative review by our 3-person board. I know this committee is not charged with funding, but please be sure to tell your colleagues that we still need that also. So this morning, the key pieces that I'm speaking to are, one, that this restores our jurisdiction. And so we are able to function and take in cases, and again, hopefully try to reduce some of that burden on the courts and also create an efficient administrative process for employers and employees. Secondly, this does make 2 minor changes, as Representative Nelson ably described, to our functions. First of all, with respect to the open meeting law, it does allow us to close our meetings right now as a 3-person board. Just 2 of us speaking together forms a quorum. I'm sure my colleagues are fine with me not forming a quorum with them as often as possible, but we need the opportunity to be able to confer about certain cases without necessarily having the meeting open every time. So many other boards have this deliberative process, and we'd like to have that as well. Secondly, this ensures that data that is non-public in the hands of a public employer would retain that classification in our hands as well. The bill is pretty surgical in making sure that it doesn't make any currently public data non-public. And I can tell you that my predecessor in the labor spot on the board did work through this a couple of sessions ago with the public data advocates, and we felt like we'd reached rapprochement on this issue, and so we thought we had the blessing of those individuals. As you know, this language has been floating around for a couple of sessions, but we are hopeful that this will be the year, and this will help us function even more efficiently. So I really appreciate your time this morning, understand the speed at which the committee is working, and thank you very much, Representative Nelson, for bringing this forward.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. I understand we have another person available, if there are, from Mediation Services, is available for questions if members have them. So with that, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson, what's happening to these cases right now?
Representative Nelson.
Right now, Madam Chair and Representative Scott, they would end up going to court either, and I my mind a little confused, but they go to court now, and so that would cost lawyer fees and things for the state and for the unions that are bringing these forward on the basis of their members.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought that was the case, Representative Nelson, and that's been the case for a number of years. And I know Representative Carlson brought this bill a number of years ago and forgot to put the funding mechanism into it. So I know you've been back to try to every single term, at least, if not every year, to try and address this. And the courts seem to be handling it just fine. And the courts aren't secretive about what happens. And so, members, I will be voting no on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Further discussion to the bill? All right. Seeing none, closing comments, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, this is about trying to do this in a more efficient manner, saving money for the state, not having to go to court for the individuals that are filing these unfair labor charges, so that they can be done in a more efficient manner, saving money again for both the state and for the individual members.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3395 be referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr? Representative Herr? Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
No.
Barr?
Barr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Fang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 9 ayes and 7 nays.
Michaela, can you call on Representative Herr again?
Representative Herr?
Aye.
10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, thank you. With that, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Nelson, and your testifier. With that, members, we have been trucking right along. So we are going to get to our heaviest lift of the day, which is the House File 2725, which is the competency restoration bill. If you remember, members, we heard this earlier this session, but there's now a DE, and so we want to make sure everyone's fully informed about the status of this bill and want to make sure everyone's clear on what the provisions are. And so Representative Edelson is not able to join us right away this morning, but I will move House File 2725 before the committee. And then I will also move House Bill 2725, the DE1 amendment, to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. So we will vote on the DE1 and then we'll have staff walk through the bill in the current form that the author wants it in. So any discussion then to the DE1? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. We're quick on the unmuting, guys. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails and the DE1 is adopted. Given that Representative Edelson is not here, we're going to turn it over to Ben Johnson from House Research, who has put in the time helping to get this bill in the right shape. And so, Mr. Johnson, if you can introduce yourself and then walk through the DE1 with us, that would be greatly appreciated.
Madam Chair, it's Ben Johnson from House Research. As you mentioned, this bill has been before the committee before, so I thought it would be most helpful to kind of briefly touch on what's the same and then highlight the things that have changed the most in the bill. So the basic concept behind the bill remains the same. That is that it addresses individuals who are found incompetent for judicial proceedings. That usually happens early in the proceedings when someone is arrested and begins before the court, but can happen at any time. Right now, this is governed by court rules. It's primarily Rule 2001 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. A lot of this bill codifies what is currently in court rule, but then it expands and has some additional protections. The basic idea remains the same, and that basic idea is that when an individual is found incompetent under the bill, they'll be connected with someone to help them walk through the process. That position is called a forensic navigator. The forensic navigator then helps them do a competency evaluation, helps connect them to appropriate services, and just kind of helps to guide those individuals through the full process. Those forensic navigator positions are new. Also in the bill, what is new is a competency restoration program. Those were in the bill before. The basic concepts have not changed, but essentially there would be competency restoration programs. Individuals would be referred to those programs, and there would be regular reviews to see if a person had attained competency after participating in the programs. That's the high-level look at what this bill does, and that has not changed fundamentally. What has changed is who's in charge of this. In the previous version of the bill, the judicial branch was tasked with all of this work, with setting up the forensic navigator and the competency restoration programs and the certification for that. That has been taken away in the DE from the judicial branch and given to a new board. That's the board is going to be very similar to, for example, the guardian ad litem board or the public defender board, in that it is technically under the judicial branch, but it is independent. If members are interested in looking at that language, it's on page 25. It starts at line 18 of the DE amendment. That board would get advice from an advisory committee made up essentially of experts who would advise on the appropriate standards, certification standards for individuals who would be the forensic navigators, and also for the various programs. This version of the bill also adds a little bit more clarity in relation to the three options for the programs related to competency restoration. There are what we are referring to in the bill as certified programs. Those programs could be in the community or could be in locked facilities, but they're outside of a jail or any facility that is like that, and they are certified then by this new board. There are also jail-based programs. Those would be certified as well, but they would take place within a jail. And then there are what are referred to as alternative programs. Those alternative programs are essentially for areas or situations where a person cannot get into a certified program and it's not appropriate for being held in jail. The way the bill is structured, there's a priority. The priority is getting individuals into certified programs that are not jail-based, getting them out of the jail when that's appropriate into a certified program. Again, some of that is in the community, but some of that is in a locked facility. But there are the jail-based programs. There's a cap on how long a person can be in the jail-based program of 90 days, typically. And there are alternative programs. Again, there's a cap on those alternative programs because they're not certified. But if a person is making progress in the alternative program after a checkup, they could stay in that program for up to 180 days. This version of the bill also establishes some additional limits on the period of time that somebody could be under supervision. This is largely due to a Supreme Court decision. It's Jackson versus Indiana. That decision did not give great guidance to states on how long they can hold people under supervision, but it does establish some direction indicating that individuals cannot be held indefinitely on supervision simply because they're incompetent and charged with a crime. The bill sets time limits. Those time limits are based on whether or not someone is in custody or out of custody. And the time limits that are established closely track the periods of time that would be used for most criminal sentences of the type or probation sentences. So, for example, a person charged with a gross misdemeanor could be sentenced to up to a year in jail, and the typical period of probation would be 2 years. And so this bill uses that structure so that a person could be held in custody for competency restoration for up to a year, or could be supervised in the community in competency restoration programs for up to 2 years. There are similar limits for both targeted misdemeanors and for felonies in the bill. The final point that is worth noting that is a significant change in the bill is that there is a new section on the administration of neuroleptic medication. And let me just find the citation for that. This is on page 15 for members. Page 15, starting at line 26, there's a new section on the administration of neuroleptic medication. I won't go into this in great detail, but it's similar to the provisions related to the to individuals who are found to be a danger to themselves or others. And so there are provisions where someone is found to not be able to make decisions on their own and forced medication is approved. Madam Chair, that obviously is a very high level walkthrough of the bill, but that gives an idea, I think, of what's in the bill that has remained the same and also the significant changes in this draft. If there are questions, and I see Representative Edelson and some of the advocates are also here now, so I'll turn it back over.
Yep, thank you very much for that walkthrough, Mr. Johnson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Edelson. So we've already accepted the DE amendment, and Mr. Johnson just walked through the differences and highlighted the changes that are different from the first time you were here this session. But I will turn it over to you to talk a little bit about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize because I don't even have the bill in front of me. I just got a quick little text. So I'm just, I'll just let you know in terms of negotiations where we are at. We have decided, and thanks to Representative Johnson for some of his comments, I think in the last committee, we have been negotiating a lot since then. And we're talking with the courts. It looks like the best place for this to live, talking with the courts and counties, is to kind of create its own board, like a guardian item, which I'm sure Mr. Johnson walked through. So we're there. There's just a few provisions that we're still negotiating, but we're very close. The bill is moving in the Senate, and I'm happy to take any questions. And I know Ms. Abner Holden is here as well, and I was just texting with the county attorneys to try to get them on too.
All right. Yeah, we'll turn it over to testifiers. So Ms. Abner Holden, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abner-Holden, Executive Director of Downey, Minnesota. I don't have anything super prepared since I was thinking I had until 5 o'clock, but I do want to say that we are working hard to try to reach a consensus. I want to say that doing nothing should not be an option. There is no perfect bill. You all know that. And this something this huge, you know, it takes a lot of pain, honestly, to get through this. But I think leaving what we currently have is not working. We're spending an enormous amount of money on competency exams that we shouldn't be doing for some folks over and over and over again. You know, the result isn't going to be any different. And we need to try to make sure that folks who are committing nonviolent crimes, who have a serious mental illness, are actually steered into treatment, right? And not just kind of released into the community without anything. I know there are some, you know, high profile cases that people are focusing on, but what we really have is most of the people who are just going back into the community without connecting to any services or supports. And that's just not good, frankly, for the individual. Some of the remaining issues have to deal with, for example, how we define mental illness. The advocates want to use a definition that already exists under Chapter 245. There's questions about the length of time, which is related to the court case that Mr. Johnson talked about. There's some disagreements there. we want the forensic navigators to really be people who are trying to connect with the individual, trying to engage them in treatment. We don't want them to be viewed as probation or providing supervision in the community. We want them to be, again, trying to really connect with that individual. There are some issues with a judge can't just send someone to a facility and say, you have to take them. Because the facilities we're sending people to actually are treatment facilities. And so the head of those treatment facilities have to accept them. You know, are they able to actually provide the care and treatment that that person needs? What is the milieu of the other patients that are in that center? Do they even have an open bed? So there are some disagreements there. We were actually trying to pull together a meeting even yet today, which now that if we're not meeting at 5 o'clock, we can probably go back to trying to meet at 5 o'clock to really continue to push and try to get consensus. And again, you know, I've worked on a lot of huge bills over my career and they're never easy. But I think that we have agreement on, I would say 75% of this bill, which I think is really pretty good. And with a little push and a little bit more listening on both sides, I think we can get to the end. But I do really want to implore you, we need to pass something this session. Something is better than nothing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. I see we also have Bob Small here from the county attorneys. Mr. Small, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Small, and I'm the executive director with the County Attorneys Association. And like Ms. Abderholden and Representative Edelson, I was on another Zoom meeting when I saw this pop up, so I skipped out of that one and am here. Sue is right that we're working hard on, we have some really excellent folks that know what they're talking about. And so I think the good news is that we are working very hard and together trying to get this accomplished. And so I really don't have anything further, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
That's okay, Mr. Small, and I'm not going to apologize for how efficient my committee is. As an assistant county attorney, as someone who also serves on the Behavioral Health Policy Committee, really appreciate the effort that's really by many, many people to get this bill moving. I think there's consensus that the status quo is not working best for folks. And I think, you know, normally we wouldn't do a complete walkthrough and two full hearings on the same bill. But if progress is being made, I think that's a really good thing. And I really appreciate all the efforts that have gone into that. With that, we will move on to member discussion. Members, any questions? All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a difficult issue. And I had a few meetings over the interim on this matter with county attorneys and with DHS, and there was just a lot of discussion around the fact that nobody's really responsible for this right now. And so I would hope that at a minimum this year, if there's no final agreement on what's being pursued right now. And Representative Adelson, thank you for working on this because this is a heavy lift. I would hope that we would at least place this competency issue back in the where I think it belongs, which is DHS. But at a minimum, we need to do something in that regard and then provide some sort of an off-ramp for people that don't rise to the level of civil commitments. So I hope that that is seen as a backup plan if there's no consensus reached on this issue. I know it won't be a cheap solution, and I've said that publicly to folks that it won't be cheap. And so, but we need to make sure that these people get the help that they need and the public is safe in the process. So those are my only comments right now. Madam Chair. And then, you know, one of the other things just real quickly was that the counties right now don't have the funds to follow these people. So that would be another piece. If DHS is going to require the, if it got, falls back to DHS and they're going to require the counties to follow these people, then there needs to be some funding for the counties to do that. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Scott. And I think that actually brought up something that I'm hoping Representative Edelson or maybe Ms. Aberholden can clarify. And I think just generally, it would be helpful to clarify what the difference is between competency to stand trial and the civil commit, what civil commitment means, because those are two different things. And I think sometimes in our shorthand of complicated mental health related things, we sometimes blur the lines a little bit. And I'm wondering, Representative Edelson, if you can just for the record to clarify, you know, what the difference is when we're talking about those two things.
You know, Madam Chair, I could, but you know who would probably do a little bit better of a job would be Ms. Aberholden. So I'm going to pass it to her, if you don't mind, Madam Chair.
Yeah, no problem. I always defer to the chief author, but I, as I mentioned, I figured she might be the one. Ms. Aberholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the difference is if someone cannot participate in their own defense, then we deem them incompetent to stand trial. Commitment is that the person is in danger of hurting themselves or others, or really can't take up their basic needs. That has nothing to do with not having income. So it is a very, very different standard. And that's why we have so many people who are deemed incompetent to stand trial are not actually committed. I do want to add one other thing is we recognize that we did not expect the counties to follow these people along. They do under commitment. That is part of their responsibility when someone is discharged. When someone is committed, they are appointed a county case manager to handle that. But under our bill, what we would do is they would only be responsible for that kind of supervision piece that we think is going to be a small number of people. And so there would be an appropriation to help them with that. But otherwise, it's the forensic navigators who would be following people into the community when they've been deemed incompetent to stand trial.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Aberholden. Moving on to more member discussion, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Edelson, thank you for trying to figure this nightmare out. Law enforcement has been dealing with this issue for decades, asking for help, trying to figure it out. One thing that I have concerns on in this bill is the timelines. Treatment, there is no timeline for treatment and for assistance. So that's one issue I have. Some of the treatment, the person could be in for whatever their sentence is up to 1 year, but the treatment might take 3 years. So they're not getting the treatment they actually need. One person, it could take 5 years. One person, they can get through the treatment in 3 months and be fine. So I don't think we can really go with timelines. I think it has to be what's best for the individual and the safety of the public. The other issue I'm not sure how we're going to deal with is the Jarvis rulings. What we find in law enforcement, we deal with the person, they might get charged with something so we can get them into our commitment, get them back into inpatient treatment program where they can be forced to take their medications. They're there for 2-3 months. They go back out in the community. A month later, they get off their meds. A month and a half later, law enforcement is dealing with them again. Because with the Jarvis ruling, it only goes into effect while they are institutionalized. So those are some of the issues that we have. I understand the concept of this bill. It's something we need to look at. I'm not sure this is the right approach at this time, but I appreciate the work you're doing. I haven't decided how I'm going to vote on this bill yet, just because we don't have the fiscal note, and I know it's going to be quite expensive, and that's something I would like to see before we actually vote on it, so we have an idea of what the cost is going to be and figure out how we're going to pay for it, because it is going to be expensive. And we also have to figure out the issue, how we're going to keep these individuals on their medications, because those are the ones that we have the most trouble with, the ones that get out, don't continue their medication. So I will leave it at that.
Any response, Representative Edelson?
Yes, Madam Speaker, and thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, this bill, I would encourage you, I hope you will consider strongly voting for it, because this bill makes a huge improvement to where we currently are. And just like, you know, we should listen to law enforcement when you're the experts on certain situations. We have county attorneys, law enforcement was at the table. We have people that are dealing with mental illness on a daily basis that haven't been involved, and they are agreeing with the solution. Something is better than nothing in this case. And right now, we're not doing enough. So, and then in terms of being followed by the courts, therapy doesn't, I mean, I'm a clinician. I can tell you, you're right. Therapy doesn't necessarily always have an end date. You have to create a treatment plan. But the reality is, this is also, you can't into perpetuity have courts following people. It creates a constitutional issue. So I think that we are dealing with that struggle, but I hear you. And we are definitely, as a collective, as experts, are trying to figure out the best way forward while having that in balance. And also, we do have, we do allow more judicial discretion in terms of making sure that people are taking medication in this legislation. So a lot of your concerns are being addressed. It will be expensive, but there's a cost to not doing anything as well. So thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair.
I guess I'll take the promotion. I will remind members too, like, this is going to Ways and Means. We're not sending this to the general register. So there is, you know, there will be further discussion. And I know many members of this committee also serve on Ways and Means. One thing I did just want to clarify from the initial walkthrough too, is if you go to page 25 with the board, that we're still establishing this within the purview of the judicial branch, but the board would not be subject to the administrative control of the judiciary. So very similar to the guardian ad litem, the Board of Public Defense, all these other boards that are housed in that category. And given that this has to do with competency to stand trial, that makes sense that we would treat it that way. So I just want to clarify that that's the way this is being set up. Members, any further discussion to the bill? All right. With that, Representative Edelson, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your guys' time this morning. And yeah, I mean, clearly there's a Freudian slip here. So you maybe become Madam Speaker at some point in the future. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2725, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Beist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Devotny?
No.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Chung? Representative Chung? That is, aye. Oh. That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right. The motion prevails and the bill is referred to Ways and Means. Thank you for joining us in the morning instead of the evening. I think it's good for all of us that we're able to check this one off the list earlier in the day. I really appreciate all of your work on this issue and this bill. So thank you. With that, members, our additional bills today will be this evening. So we've got 12 minutes to spare. We'll note that the first bill up this evening will be House File 1134, Representative Daniels' bill. So we'll just appreciate your patience with us figuring out the technology so that our deaf and hard of hearing testifiers can fully participate in the hearing. So with that, we are in recess, and I will see you all at 5 o'clock. Thank you. With that, I will reconvene this remote hearing of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. We will get right to it. We've got a couple more bills this evening. The first bill on our agenda this evening is House File 1134. It is a Representative Daniels bill. I will move House File 1134 be referred to the General Register. And then Representative Daniels, I see we have an A22 amendment that just updates an effective date. So I will also move the A22 amendment. Any questions about the amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee, Representative Daniels. I think this is your first time joining us. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair Becker-Finn and the committee members for hearing House File 1134 today. In 2016, the legislature recognized the rights of about 20% of Minnesotans who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing to access closed captioning services in certain medical facilities. It was a big step towards the deaf and hard of hearing communities that we cherish. It was a big victory for that, for our group. They said the need to stay informed on time-sensitive matters like emergencies with weather broadcasts or a geopolitical crisis like the current tragedy in Ukraine is not restricted to hospital waiting rooms. That is why we are presenting House File 1134 with us today. House File 1134, any place providing television service to their clients, customers, would require to enable the closed captioning feature already available on modern TVs. In addition to relaying time-sensitive information, the enabling of closed captioning in these spaces would create a more welcoming and inclusive environment for our friends in the deaf and hard of hearing community. Further, just a non-disabled benefit from existing disability accommodations like curb cutouts and elevators, the deaf and hard of hearing will not be the only ones benefiting from this bill. Who here doesn't think that having closed caption on in a noisy bar or restaurant is not a bad idea? While the Minnesota Human Rights Act can actually cover this matter, but it's not specific enough. So that's kind of why we brought this bill to you tonight. It makes a more equitable experience for the deaf and hard of hearing community and just takes another step towards the equity. Since I know our time is limited, so Madam Chair, I would like to have my testifiers present their stories of why closed captioning is important to them. I would like to start with a person that has long been involved in these issues, Jan McCready Johnson. With your permission, Chair.
All right, and we do have several testifiers. Happy to have you all in committee today. We'll get started with Jan McCready Johnson. Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Becker-Finn, and members of the committee. My real name is Janai McCready Johnson, and next to me is my husband, Neil Johnson. We have been longtime advocates, and we are strongly in support of House File 1134, closed caption in public places. For about 10 years, we have taken many steps to advocate to get a bill passed for closed caption in public places, but there's still no law, but I'm hoping that we are making progress today. We love to go out to eat. We've had many experiences out in public places where we ask to have the captions turned on, and most of the time, employees will say that they can't do it or they don't have time to do it, or they give us kind of an attitude about that request. So that's very frustrating for us. So I'm going to turn it over to Neil because he wants to share a piece too. Hello, committee and chair. I just have a short story about an experience that we had. We went to a bar and grill for dinner. It was during March Madness, so all of the TVs were on the basketball tournament. It was great to be able to watch all the games, but none of the TVs had captions on. But then when I went to the bathroom, when I was in the restroom, I was standing at the urinal and looked up, and there was a TV with captions in the bathroom. And so I was just like, what is this about? So I'd like to share with you as a committee members to think about if you were in my shoes. Imagine that you're in some place where you can't hear what is being said. And if someone said that you have to turn on the sound and people said no, that they wouldn't turn the sound on for you to give you access for that, and think about how would you feel if you were in that situation. And that's how we, people who are deaf, part of hearing a deaf line, feel when we can't access the information in public places because the captions are not on. And we're here today in the hope that the bill will pass and become law. And that's the last time that we'll have to testify. So please support us. And thank you for supporting captioning in public places for everyone to have access. Thank you. Thank you very much, Esniel.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. We don't want you to have to go stand in the bathroom to watch your basketball games, Neil. Next on our agenda, we have next on the list to testify, I have Wayman Hudson.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, you can't see the interpreter. We need to have the interpreter as a gallery. Great. It's six now, I think.
All right. Did you guys get that figured out?
Yeah.
Yep. We're all set.
Okay. All right. Next on the list is Wayman Hudson. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Great. Thank you all for having us today. My name is Wayman Hudson. I'm late deafened. About 5 years ago, I got sick for about a week. It was just the flu, nothing big. But I found out shortly thereafter I have a genetic anomaly that this fever kicked into gear, and I lost my hearing within a year. So to me, captions are the only way I can interact with the world when it comes to television. I've been at restaurants when there have been big announcements. There's been news conferences, deaths of favorite celebrities, really important stuff that has come through and really been impactful. And all I can get is the ticker at the bottom. And that doesn't have all the information we need. I've been in a restaurant when there was a COVID briefing going on, and they were playing the briefing, which was great to get information out, but there were no captions for us. So it was incredibly difficult to get that information. I'm lucky I know enough sign language to be able to see the interpreter. I love that about Minnesota, that we always have an interpreter present. But it's a challenge. It's not only about but it's also about the small things. When I go to the gym, I would like to be able to watch the news or watch my favorite HGTV show. Everyone else there can. But often deaf and hard of hearing folks are left out of just the everyday things that most people take for granted. And I'll tell you, as someone who's been on both sides of that world, you shouldn't take it for granted. You never know. And this is such an important, important thing for so many people, not just people like me who are deaf, but like everyone has said, people with all kinds of disabilities. People that, maybe have age-related hearing loss, or sometimes it's just loud. So it's really a something that will benefit everyone. And this is one of those few bills you can pass where there are no costs. There's nothing, no burden to put on anyone. It takes about 3 to 5 minutes, depending how well you know your TV, to put on subtitles, if that. And then they can stay on. You just never have to turn them off. So this isn't an inconvenience for anyone. It's just making sure that everyone has equity when it comes to communication and receiving information. So thank you very much for listening to our testimony today. And thank you very much for the support of this bill. It's very appreciated, and it actually impacts a ton of lives. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Laura Hageman. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Laura Hageman, and I'm the, I apologize. I had dental work just a little bit ago, so I'm a little numb. So anyway, my name is Laura Hageman, and I'm the Director at Large and Social Media Specialist for Hearing Loss of America, Association of America, Twin Cities Chapter here in Minnesota. And I'm here to testify in support of 1134. In 2016, I was in a near-fatal car accident and suffered a severe traumatic brain injury and was in a coma for 3 weeks. Once out of the coma, the TBI had affected my hearing, and I was deaf for 3 months. My hearing came back gradually, but is highly distorted and altered, which makes me rely on assisted technology like closed captions. When I was first injured, I was in a situation where alarms went off at the hospital when I was waiting for MRI. Since I was deaf and my newly injured brain was slow to respond and react, I was confused and scared, and I didn't know what was happening. Thankfully, the ASL interpreter with me recognized my confusion and pointed to the flashing lights. You should know that I don't know sign language. And after I was recognized that I was deaf, I was assigned ASL interpreters who had to interpret and teach me at the same time. The situation with the alarms in the hospital made me realize that I was vulnerable and completely reliant on hearing people around me. That was a shock. After 37 years of being fiercely independent, for example, what happens when you see an emergency alert on TV? I remember you hear a sound. But now all I see is a black screen, where closed captioning would help me and others not be reliant on hearing friends or family. It can be dangerous and confusing for me. And as an independent person, I do not want to have to rely on hearing people to tell me what is happening. If all public information was closed captioned, I would have access to the same information as those who are hearing, giving me back a little bit of the independence I lost after the accident. Thank you for your time and hearing my story and supporting this bill that I know will help the deaf and hard of hearing community, but also the brain injury community.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Sean Riff. If you can introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sean Riff, retired Army major with 25 years of Army experience. I currently work as the development director for the Minnesota Assistant Council for Veterans, and I'm here today to request your support on HF 1134, always on captioning in public places. Like many veterans, I have noise-induced high-frequency hearing loss, a condition caused by repeated exposure to loud noise. This has caused me to struggle with differentiating sounds and settings with any background noise, such as restaurants, sporting events, lobbies, mass transit, or any place where people gather. I'd like to take this opportunity to advocate for both myself and for other veterans who struggle with the same issue during their service to the armed forces. In almost all places I have mentioned, access to televisions or monitors is common. Without access to captioning, I have little to no understanding of what is being said on a broadcast. I have an assertive personality and have taken no issue asking someone to turn on captioning, but rarely is this a simple task. Most people with a hearing loss don't wish to bring attention to themselves for something that most people will benefit from. Let me give you a short anecdote to show you the impact this bill could have for the future. As recently as the 1960s, paraplegic students at the University of California, Berkeley, were trying to gain independence by attending college. One of the biggest hurdles they found was not, in fact, gaining acceptance to the school, but faced by the limitations caused by the curbs in front of the buildings they needed to enter. These students advocated and sometimes took matters in their own hands, creating the first curb cuts, which allowed them access to sidewalks and therefore access to entrances we all take for granted. Today, curb cuts are commonplace on the corner of every street in America. While designed for people with mobility challenges, these points are used by families with strollers, mail carriers with dollies, and even kids on bikes. Creating a simple point of access created a new normal we can all benefit from. This bill has similar potential for creating a new normal in the way we access information on screens. When captioning options are present, all viewers benefit from the service. People without hearing loss can visually cue on words that are misheard, identify voices that are off screen, and we can start to lower the background sounds that are exponentially increasing in our lives. Additionally, making this a common practice encourages others to advocate for more uses of captioning, such as stage theater, sporting events, without having to request special access or being singled out as individuals who need accommodations. Supporting this bill of always-on captioning in public places is a simple step in providing equitable access to communication and expanding the greater potential of closed captioning to all. I thank you for your time and consideration for listening to me today.
Thank you for your testimony. The last testifier I have on the list is Sunny Wazalowski. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sunny Wazalowski, and I'm in strong support of this bill. Because being deaf can be a tremendous burden to have to go up and ask all the time to ask for that access. And this will benefit everyone. It'll benefit seniors, all the different intersectionalities of people will benefit from this and take the burden off people who have those experiences. It's really being included instead of having to pursue that access. So I want to thank all the people who have testified this and for their support. So thank you for the support for this bill.
Thank you very much. So that wraps up our testifier list. Thank you to all of our testifiers. We really appreciate hearing from all of you. And we'll move on to member discussion. I will also say, I have a close family member who uses a wheelchair, and the extra burden and how unwelcome we feel when we have to ask for extra accommodations when we go to public places is something that I'm very familiar with in my own family. And so I really appreciate you all sharing your personal stories as well. I think it's something hopefully we can all relate to. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank all the testifiers that brought their voice to this conversation. And thank you, Representative Daniels, for the bill. I think it's a small thing that can be done that will be helpful to a lot of people. So thank you.
Any further discussion, members? Representative Daniels, Representative Daniels and I have partnered on several bills for our deaf and hard of hearing Minnesotans, and I was glad that we could get this bill moving this year. Representative Daniels, I will go to you for closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I really appreciate the committee hearing this bill. I also like to thank the testifiers for their story. Kind of puts in perspective, you know, what they go through on a daily basis. And I didn't mention before, but my oldest son is deaf, and he was classmates with Sonny Wozlowski. And it's a whole different world out there if you're deaf in the hearing world. And I don't want to make it really hard for the restaurants and bar industry to do this, but I don't believe it'll be a big lift. We're going to give them an extra 12 months to incorporate getting closed captioning on the TVs. In the bill, we've taken out all the teeth, so there's really no penalties in there if it's not done right away. So we're trying to make it, you know, appeasable for everyone. And if there's anything that we've missed, I'm certainly open to working with anybody to make the bill a better bill. I don't think we've ever had a perfect bill leave the House floor. It's always good to use some changes. But I believe this bill will get us one step closer to having the deaf and hard of hearing community to be more included in everyday functions. And speaking of a father with a deaf son, it's I didn't want to bring him into this, but it's part of our life for the last 4 years. And to see what they can't do is frustrating. And to see with a little bit of help what they can do is really gratifying. So, again, I just thank you for time to present this bill. And I if there's anything that I can do to answer any questions, I'd be more than happy to do that. And thank you to committee as well.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Daniels. Maybe one day we'll have a perfect bill. Who knows? With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1134, as amended, be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
Aye.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Liebling.
Aye.
Long.
Aye.
Mortensen. Representative Mortensen. Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Farr.
Farr, aye.
Robbins.
Aye.
Bang.
Aye.
Zhang.
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and 0 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to the General Register. Again, I want to thank all of our testifiers, and I also want to thank our interpreters. We got to use some new technology today, and I was really glad that we were able to include everybody. It really is the way that it should be. So thank you, Representative Daniels and our testifiers. With that, we will move on to the next bill. The next bill on our agenda is House File 4314. It is a Representative Hansen R. bill. I will move House File 4314 be referred to Ways and Means. I'm going to assume Representative Hansen is somewhere on this Zoom. There you are, Chair Hansen. With that, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 4314 is a follow-up on a long-running issue with the Packing House Workers' Bill of Rights and Worker Safety. There are provisions here that are relating to your committee, and I have, this is an agency bill that results from a task force that was created during COVID and we have agency folks here to testify as to the provisions.
All right, I've got Jessica Groves. If you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Groves, and I'm the Director of Labor Standards and Apprenticeship at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4314. This legislation reflects one of the recommendations made by the Agricultural Worker Wellness Committee to the governor on December 1st, 2021. The committee was established via Executive Order 2114 and is comprised of local and regional representatives, worker representatives, community representatives, state agency representatives, and employer representatives. I am part of the state agency support staff team for the committee, and the recommendation related to this legislation was approved unanimously by the committee members who were present for the November 22nd, 2021 committee meeting. House File 4314 updates and expands enforcement mechanisms for three worker protection laws that currently exist in Minnesota. One of these laws, the Migrant Labor Law, was enacted in 1981, and its most recent update was in 2005. Many of its provisions have never been updated. A second law, the Recruitment and Food Processing Employment Law, was enacted in 1995 and has never been updated. Similarly, the third law, the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights, has never been updated and was enacted in 2007. Among other changes, this legislation updates these laws and expands enforcement mechanisms in the following ways. In relation to the Migrant Labor Law, it provides DLI with enforcement authority so that it can issue compliance orders and penalties for violations of this law, and it adjusts for inflation the penalties that are currently available to plaintiffs under this law. In relation to the Recruitment and Food Processing Employment Law, it adjusts for inflation the damages available to plaintiffs under this law, and adjusts for inflation the fines available to DLI for violations of the law. And in relation to the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights, the legislation provides for a private right of action, as well as authority for DLI to take action to address violations of the law. This legislation would update penalties, damages, or fines available under these laws enacted years ago to reflect today's dollars. It would also expand the enforcement mechanisms available to address and resolve violations of these worker protection laws. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for your time and consideration of this legislation.
All right, thank you for your testimony. We will move on to member discussion. We'll just remind members this bill is before us because there are civil penalties and some enforcement mechanisms that fall within our committee's jurisdiction, and so we will stick to those areas. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess if nobody else is going to speak to it, I will, and I know you said these are penalties are being adjusted for inflation, and it just seems like kind of a cruel time to be doing it, after these businesses have gone through COVID and are trying to recover from that. And so I just, it just seems that the assault on business continues, and we still haven't gotten the UI bill passed. So I'll be a no vote today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And any response, Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, the packing houses, the meatpacking business, had one of the highest rates of not only infection but death during COVID. It is a dangerous business. 1981 is one of the first laws that's referenced here was passed. In 1981, I was a senior in high school. I wore my collar outside of my suit jacket, and my hair was fluffed back. It's a long time ago. 1981 was a long time ago. And inflation has occurred since then, during the Reagan years, the Bush years, the Clinton years, the Bush years, the Obama years, the Trump years, and now in the Biden. So a consequence needs to be meaningful. In the previous hearing, we heard that the teeth aren't even there for a $50 fine. So the agency hasn't been able to act. So this is the right thing to do, to update this for all three of these bills. It's the right thing to do for the workers who work in these dangerous jobs for us to be able to eat. Takes somebody to process the food. It just doesn't magically appear on our plate. So when there is a violation, then the penalties need to be sufficient to reduce and prevent future violations that put health and safety at risk for the workers and for us. I'd ask for your support.
Members, any further discussion to the bill? All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4314 be referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen? Navani?
Navani, no.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Vang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Last bill on our agenda today, I can't believe it's 5:33 and I'm saying that. Hopefully I haven't jinxed us. I'm knocking on wood. The sun is still shining behind the clouds, is House File 3594, a Representative Edelson bill. I will move House File 3594 be referred to Ways and Means. I also understand there is an A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Edelson, can you tell us briefly what the A1 does?
Just technical language changes, Madam Chair.
Got it. Any discussion to the A1? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Second time before the committee today. Exciting. House File 3594 addresses the recruitment of guardians ad litem in Hennepin and Ramsey County. It directs the board and administrators to work to eliminate barriers to attract, accept, train, and utilize volunteer guardians ad litem. The guardians ad litem we are discussing in this bill are also known as court-appointed special advocates. While a social worker in a child protection case is focused on the family, a guardian is really a second set of eyes for the judge and is really focused specifically on the child in the best interest. Volunteer guardians ad litem have been around in Minnesota for 40 years. Former Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Kathleen Blatz was instrumental in Minnesota adopting this current model. I believe now it's in 23 other states. By statutes, volunteers follow the same program standards, training, procedures, and rules as employee guardians and are supervised by an employee guardian ad litem. They are carefully screened and thoroughly trained to work with children and youth who have experienced abuse and neglect and advocate for their best interests. Volunteers are critical to creating community awareness and support. They bring diverse backgrounds, reduce workload for courts and state employees, and provide a check and balance to ensure a child's perspective is being considered in the process. This bill is being brought before you today because the volunteer guardian litem pool has not been open to new applicants since the start of the pandemic. For example, in Hennepin County, they went from approximately pre-pandemic 250 volunteers to now 88. When I have approached the administration about this, I was informed that they are assessing the program. As a result of continued assessing of this program, the trained volunteer pool is down 50%. I have been informed that over 200 qualified and diverse candidate applications are waiting to be vetted to be a volunteer guardian ad litem. I think this committee knows it takes a village to raise kids. It is invaluable to have this role and not have it phased out. Doing away with the guardian ad litem volunteer program most certainly will create higher caseloads for staff and more burdens on the child protective system that is unfortunately always struggling to keep up. I'm quite sure when this body increased guardian ad litem funding last year that the intention was not to get rid of the volunteer system that was working. I myself was a guardian ad litem in Hennepin County for over 4 years, many years ago. I know firsthand the value that these volunteers do to help kids and families in our community as a whole. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to move my testifiers, and I believe someone from Hennepin and Ramsey possibly is here from as well.
All right, thank you. First on the list, I have Gerard Bodell. If you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair and Committee. I am Gerard Bodell. I am a volunteer guardian ad litem in the 4th Judicial District, which covers Hennepin County, and I also serve as the volunteer president of CASA Minnesota, a decades-old Minnesota nonprofit advocating for foster kids. 37% of children in the United States will be part of a child protection investigation. This is shocking and unacceptable. I'm here because the children in our community who are abused or neglected need more resources, not fewer. I want to speak specifically about why those resources must include volunteer guardians ad litem. Myself and other volunteers, we often hear from kids, "You are the only person in my life that doesn't get paid to help me." Even in the most challenging of circumstances, children are smart and they are intuitive and they understand the value of someone being with them without being required to be there. As Minnesota statewide senior judge Lionel Norris, who himself was impacted, helped, and motivated by people in the community that wanted to help him, has said, surrounding kids with only paid state employees can create an institutionalized effect. Volunteers matter. We help to enhance and add balance to a system. We help humanize a process which can otherwise feel very cold. But most importantly, we are there for kids. As a volunteer, I take on 1 to 2 cases at a time, as opposed to employees who take on up to 30 cases at one time. And each case in Hennepin County contains on average 3 to 4 kids. 30 cases at a time. That is not only time spent with each child, but it's appearing in court, writing reports, investigating and learning to form recommendations. While the state has wonderful, dedicated employees, that is a huge workload for anyone to manage. With a more focused caseload, I'm able to engage with children that I'm supporting in a different way than an employee can. I currently volunteer on a case with 3 kids who are placed with a relative foster parent outside of the metro area. I drive 2 hours to get there, 4 hours round trip to see the kids. I visit them at school. I sit in their classrooms. I meet with teachers, their coaches, mental health workers, and others in their lives. I visit the foster home. I work with their parents too. I strive to understand their needs so I can advocate for the services that will support them. As a volunteer, I have the time to spend. I'm choosing to invest my time with these kids because I care about them. And I also care about our community. More than 40 years ago, we were among the first in the country to start a volunteer guardian ad litem program. The program is now nationwide at 93,000 volunteer guardian ad litems across 49 states plus the District of Columbia. And at least 22 states have statutes supporting the volunteers, supporting them so that there's consistency in the program, supporting them so that
Mr. Bodell, yes. I just have to ask you to wrap up. We've got several other testifiers we need to get to.
So, over the years, the volunteers have gone on to deliver change in our community. Some have started nonprofits, written books, donated millions. In fact, One has just opened a $12 million affordable housing unit in Minneapolis for youth aging out of foster care. So yes, it takes time and money and effort to include the community, and it takes time to supervise volunteers, but we're worth every penny. And so I'm asking you today, in conclusion, please support the bill that reinforces our commitment to kids by providing the support for the guardian ad litem board to work to eliminate barriers, attract and accept and train and utilize the volunteers. So this bill, together with your leadership, we can enhance this proven model that works, begin working with the more than 200 backlog applicants that are ready and willing and diverse to volunteer, and then involve the community in addressing the challenges that just cannot be solved alone by government. But most importantly, we can show up in a meaningful way for the most vulnerable kids in our state. So please, let's ensure there are more resources, not fewer, for the children who have experienced abuse and neglect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Grace Jones. Please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Grace Jones. I have been a volunteer guardian ad litem for Hennepin County for the last 17 years. I was introduced to the program 17 years ago when my two great nephews was taken into child protection. At that time, there was a social worker by the name of Vicki Moore who told me that it was not normal for kids to play house. So when I decided to start my education at Inver Hills Community College, where I've been employed for 24 years, I joined the Human Service Program. Ms. Vicki Moore directed me to the Guardian Ad Litem program, which agreed to take me on as an internship. That day, 17 years ago, I was asked to go sit on the third floor and shadow in the courtrooms. That day, on my way home, I cried the whole way home. It was unbelievable to me to see the level of abuse that kids were going through in this state. At the time, my husband was a police officer, and he told me that I couldn't go back. I went back, and I've been going back for 17 years. And over the last 17 years, I have advocated for over 130 abused and neglected kids. I've assisted those kids with being reunited with some of their biological parents and families. Some of them have been placed in permanent foster homes, but as a guardian ad litem and as a volunteer guardian ad litem, it was such an honor to be able to advocate for these kids in these situations. I've seen so many kids in court with nobody there to support them. I've seen kids go through this system and the judges change, the attorneys change, the social workers change, but we stay steady in the kids' lives. As a recovering addict of 28 years of crack cocaine, I can have personal relationships with the parents that are dealing with drugs because I'm able to tell them my story. And I'm able to say to them, I'm no better than you. Look at me. If I can do it, you can do it. So, you know, a lot of us guardians, we're volunteers, and we do this because we have a passion for it. We do it because we want nothing but the best for these kids that are being abused and neglected. The judges really take our recommendations into account. A current case that I have, this lady has 9 kids. They're in 4 different placements. She has 3 kids at home in diapers. So that means every month for this one case that I volunteer for, I have to go to 4 different placements to visit these kids. We are held accountable just like anybody else to the case. We are a party to the case. We have to fill out reports. We have to fill out in a COSMO system. We report everything. I am one of the many volunteers that, even though we get paid for mileage, we don't even accept that. We do this strictly because we want to help abused and neglected kids out here that don't have a voice. We are their voice in court. It is our job to recommend what is the best interest of that child. And sometimes that can be hard. but that's our job, and we take that on as volunteers. So I just want to ask you to please support this bill. Please, any dollars that we can give for recruiting. I've been a part of many recruiting efforts. We used to do big things like we had events at the Viking stadiums. We just had different funding where we could have events where we could target diverse people. We could target Black males to help us with the Black males that's in the child protection system. So that's my testimony today. I just want to ask you to please support this bill. And I really appreciate you taking the time and giving me the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for your service to our community. It's a really important job that you're doing. So thank you. Next on the list, I have Tammy Baker Olson from the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. Ms. Baker Olson, please go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening, Chair Becker Finn and committee members. My name is Tammy Baker Olson. I am the State Program Administrator for the Guardian Ad Litem Program. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk this evening regarding House File 3594. Because this bill is in support of volunteer guardians ad litem, I want to start by thanking all of our program volunteers serving in the 2nd and 4th districts. Minnesota has a unique and innovative guardian ad litem program model. The Minnesota Guardian Ad Litem Program is predominantly staffed by guardian ad litem employees, with 4% of our current caseload being supported by volunteers in 2 of the 10 judicial districts. The bill before you today would compel the Guardian Ad Litem Program to actively recruit volunteer guardians ad litem with the assumption that this would increase the current quality and efficacy of overall guardian ad litem advocacy. This is unsupported by facts. The Guardian Ad Litem Program's concerns about this bill are many, beginning with the greater cost and inefficiencies associated with a volunteer versus employee model. In order to be in compliance with the proposed legislation, the Guardian Ad Litem Program is charged with bringing on an additional 200 volunteers. According to CASA guidelines, this would require an additional 6.5 full-time supervisory staff and would increase the program biennial base budget by $1,390,000. Further concerns are the inefficiencies of a volunteer model, as volunteers carry significantly smaller caseloads. As a comparison, 200 volunteers with 1.5 cases will cover 300 cases. Conversely, it would take 10 employee guardians ad litem to cover 300 cases, requiring only 1.25 supervisory staff. Recent program changes have been made to optimize the use of program resources to improve upon the quality of advocacy for the children and families we serve. Among the initiatives is the creation of an independent family court division, as was recommended in 2017 per a national state court study. This is the same study that recommended moving away from a volunteer guardian ad litem model. The Guardian Litem Program is also transitioning all ICWA cases to an independent ICWA division of specially trained ICWA leadership and advocates. By implementing a Guardian Litem ICWA policy manual, specialized training in collaboration with the U of M, and ICWA-specific court reports, management have made significant improvements in Guardian Litem ICWA advocacy statewide. Requiring the Guardian Ad Litem Program to increase the current pool of volunteers in the 2nd and 4th districts would strain current program resources, targeting the 2 judicial districts where BIPOC children and families are the most represented. H.R. 3594 gives CASA Minnesota the sole responsibility to utilize general fund money without statutory authority under the laws related to guardians ad litem. CASA recruiting and training of guardians ad litem is incompatible with Minnesota State Statute 480.35. The GAL program in Minnesota is responsible to 2 appointing authorities, the Chief Justice and the Governor, as well as the legislature via the legislative audit. There is simply no authority under authorizing statute for state employees to work alongside nonprofit employees to fulfill program responsibilities. In conclusion, House File 3594 removes from the Guardian Ad Litem Board the sole authority and responsibility to operate the Guardian Ad Litem Program as the board no longer decides on its own whether volunteers or employees will be used to fulfill board duties. I respectfully assert that the guardian ad litem leadership are in the best position to determine how quality advocacy services are delivered to the children and families we serve. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on the list, I have Victor Walker. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairperson Becker Finn and other distinguished state representatives and guests. I want to take this opportunity to thank you in allowing my input regarding Bill HF3591. But first, let me introduce myself in background as it relates to volunteerism in the future direction of the State Guardian Ad Litem Program. I arrived on the doorsteps of child advocacy volunteerism over 20 years ago. I started as a volunteer, accepted a contractual position in the program, and promoted to a staff guardian ad litem position. Eventually, I was promoted as a coordinator and recently accepted the fourth judicial court guardian ad litem managerial position 1 year ago. Over the course of 20 years, I have recruited, trained, and supervised volunteers for the program. During this time, I was involved in developing a national curriculum, training for the recruitment and training of volunteers that is currently used today with National CASA. I have continued to promote and respect the children and families we serve that is comprised of 80 to 85% of children of color within the second and fourth district court. When I accepted the position as the fourth district program manager, one of my first initiatives was to assess the performance of our current volunteers and our partnership with CASA Minnesota. I met with representatives from CASA Minnesota and outlined my future goals and expectations. Initially, what I had outlined to this group was met with some regret, but a decision to put on hold to recruit and train volunteers have been made prior to my accepting this position. I had offered Minnesota CASA other methods of volunteerism with the goal of making a difference in a child's life. CASA Minnesota was fully aware of the program's plans 2 to 3 years prior to the pandemic to stop recruitment of volunteers. I'm also concerned that recruitment of volunteers is only being proposed on the second and fourth district, where the volunteer base thus far does not reflect the community in which we serve. I have stated on many occasions that we are seeking to train and support our current base of volunteers so that representation is consistent and transparent, so much so that you cannot tell the difference from a volunteer or staff. The program administrator and I agreed to remove staff as the executors of a nonprofit and for the CASA Minnesota to elect its first volunteer chairperson, which elected Mr. Gerard Bodell. The program administrator and I have kept Minnesota CASA informed every step of the way. This has led to a partnership in developing a monthly quarterly newsletter to strengthen our communications with volunteers and to support them regarding training and development. We also introduced a partnership with Wim Mitchell Law School Mentoring Program that would encourage those who want to volunteer and make an ongoing difference in a child's life, as opposed to offering an opinion to the court that is limited and from a personal perspective. The program has continued to inform this body that we are evaluating not only the quality of advocacy for volunteers, but for employees as well, because what's at stake is the lives of children and their families. What has led me to present before this committee is based upon the population we serve in the greater Twin Cities metro area, as opposed to the presentation of national CASA data that can be challenged with all due respect. As the fourth district program manager, I'm required to make decisions to support goals and future directives. I would encourage everyone to to read the NCSC 2017 report, which includes 8 recommendations for the program to advance quality advocacy for the children and families we serve. The executive board has adopted 7 out of the 8 recommendations thus far. CASA Minnesota board was fully aware of these recommendations prior to my promotion, and at no given time nor opportunity opposed these recommendations. I have been as transparent in the ongoing assessment of volunteers and will produce to the Guardian Ad Litem board what's effects for a future of advocacy for children and families in the greater metro area. As the first African-American program manager in the 4th District Guardian Ad Litem history, I implore this committee to allow for the state Guardian Ad Litem board and its leadership to do as we are mandated and well within state of Minnesota statutes to do. Thank you for your time and patience regarding this matter.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Oh, wow, Madam Chair. This seems like, I don't know, kind of a turf war or something going on here. I'm not really understanding why, when you've got some very effective volunteers, I mean, I've not seen this study that Mr. Walker mentioned, these 7 or 8 recommendations. I don't know if Representative Edelson has seen those. I just have a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that we've got some excellent volunteers that care about kids, that are making a difference in their lives, and we're telling them no thank you. I think this brings up a broader issue in that, you know, we have a lot, we've got the silver tsunami happening and going to happen for some time. And one of the things that people that are of that age, retirement age, have, they may not always have a lot of financial resources, but they have time. And if they care and they want to step forward and volunteer in a program like this and be trained to do it, I don't know how we can afford to say no. Ms. Jones, one of the most powerful testimonies I've ever seen in any committee at all was your testimony tonight. And so thank you for what you've done for these kids. And I mean, your story is just so compelling, and so thank you for all that you've done. Representative Edelson, can you help me understand why they are doing this with the volunteers, and what are these 8 suggestions or 8 action items that they're talking about, and why they're getting want to phase out the volunteers? Thanks.
Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I think it's a good question. I think you're asking really good questions, and I've been working to try to figure this out as well. You know, at one point, I know there's 4% of the volunteers now, but at one point, there has been 16% of the cases were carried by volunteers is the last number I received. So, I mean, I just want to make sure that the committee is aware of what's happening. And the funds, by the way, would go to the State Guardian Ad Litem program. I want to make sure that that's clear. It wouldn't go to CASA. The money is that's in this. And I think that what we have to look at is we have a workforce shortage before us. We have a lot of, by 2030, to the point, Representative Scott, that you're making, by 2030, baby boomers will all be 65 or older. So, and to, you know, Mr. Walker, I was a guardian ad litem when you were at the county. I can't tell you what great work you do, but losing this program, when we have diverse candidates that actually would reflect the community, I continue to agree with you that we need to have more diversity, but I don't think that's getting away with the program. And also, we have a surplus now. We might not have that in prior years. So I want to make sure that we're not getting rid of something that puts in protections for kids. So thank you, Representative Scott, for your questions.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Walker, I would love to see that report. If you could furnish that to the chair or the committee administrator, and they could distribute that to the rest of us, I think we'd all be very interested in seeing those recommendations and reading that report, because this just doesn't seem to make sense right now.
Representative Edelson, I actually have a question. Do you know why the county hasn't chosen to hire more guardians? You know, it strikes me that, you know, they're not asking us for more funding to provide them. And I'm just wondering if you can, that's sort of, maybe that's where things aren't making sense here that I think a lot of us are feeling. Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Walker or Ms. Baker would be best a position, but I imagine we do have a workforce shortage, so I wonder if that has anything to do with it. I think they have a lot of, they've increased staff from our call, but I don't think they have every position filled.
Mr. Walker, Ms. Baker Olson, do you want to take that?
Madam Chair, I can take that. Thank you. Thank you for your questions. So we currently don't have a wait list in Hennepin as we've had in the past. That has been an issue in the past, and so we leaned more on volunteers at one time. I do want to make very clear, we have no intention in continuing to not support our current core of volunteers. What we are is we're in assessment mode. And when we look at supervising and we look at the CASA standards, what's being proposed, we don't have the foundation to support. We don't have the supervisory ability to support what's being discussed here. And we meet monthly with Gerard, and we've been having conversations about assessing our current numbers. What's different from the, I kind of led with talking about the uniqueness of Minnesota's program or model. What's unique to Minnesota, CASA standards for supervision are one supervisor to 30 guardians, not exceeding 45 cases. We have coordinators who are currently supervising up to 20 plus volunteers with, I believe the range when I looked last was 5 to 7, 5 to 6 employee guardians with caseloads. So we're over capacity as we are with supervisory workload that we're assessing. So to increase, and this is what we've been in conversation with Gerard and Mike about the CASA board members, to increase now while we're assessing the quality of our advocacy statewide doesn't make sense. When we have the information to say, this is what we would need, one-time dollars, with all due respect, won't cut it, because if we bring these bodies in, we don't have the supervisory capacity to train and support. So that is my answer. When we were funded last biennium, we were able to bring more employees on. The intention we did at the pre-pandemic ceased recruitment to assess as we brought in employees and hired employees, and then the pandemic hit, and here we are. We are absolutely in assessment mode. We are committed to and monitored by our governing board to report back to the board regarding the quality of advocacy in both volunteer work as well as employee work.
Madam Chair, can I just say one thing?
Representative Edelson.
Just to that, with the volunteer pool that is there, my understanding is there's many diverse candidates. And if the goal is to increase diverse, making sure that kids are having what reflects the community, I guess it is confusing with this. And historically, again, when I was a guardian, this was 20 years ago, they were able to do it. And so it's not like this is a new program. It's a well-funded program through the state. So,
all right, Representative Johnson, and then we'll move on.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Edelson, thank you for bringing this bill. I've worked with many guardian ad litems, both volunteer and employee guardian ad litems. The employees are do good work, but the volunteers have the passion for it. They do it voluntarily. They don't get paid. They have a love for the kids that they work with. They want to make sure those kids are in being cared for. They want to make sure they're in a loving home, because it takes a family to raise a child. This program, I've been in the situation more than one time where I've had to remove a child from a home. It could have been drugs, it could have been other issues, alcohol, hoarding, multiple different issues. The goal was to get those children back in their home with their parents. Unfortunately, that doesn't always work all the time. But when you go to court and the guardian ad litem's been working with the kids, you see the kids, the first bath they've had in weeks, clean clothes. They're smiling and happy compared to the way we saw them when we unfortunately had to remove them from the home. The vast majority working through the system get their children back, and they work with the workers to make sure that they can keep their children. But the passion these volunteers have for their kids is priceless. And I want to thank every one of those volunteers for the work they do, because they do a fabulous job. I support this bill, and I think we should do our best to have as many volunteers as we can, because they do a fantastic job, and they do it not for the money, but for the love of the children and a passion to love those kids. So thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this forward.
I thank you, Representative Johnson, and I do want to be clear. We are just as grateful for the people who make this their life's work and do this for a living. I don't think we need to make the distinction about the motives for why people do this important work. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill. I did have a question. For one of the testifiers, I was wondering, you referenced this assessment period you're going through. Could you explain, that process? How long is that going to take? And then what are the next steps or what's the process?
I think that was to Ms. Baker Olson. I'm not sure who your question was directed to.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, Ms. Baker Olson.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. And Representative, so our ongoing assessment has been really taking a look at it as all state agencies coming out of the pandemic. What are our numbers? What is our work going to look like? We're looking at caseloads. We're looking at we recently did some increased hiring. So we're really assessing the level of support and training we've provided specifically volunteer guardians. As I stated, we give updates to Gerard as we meet monthly regarding this assessment period. So we don't have a timeline on it at this time. So that's about as good of an answer as I can give you at this time. I do want to emphasize that what is most problematic is the one-time funding with what's being proposed, because we can bring bodies in. If we don't have the supervisory staff, we're not going to have the quality of advocacy that we're striving for.
I apologize. I had to yell at my children to stop yelling. any follow-up, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick follow-up, and I believe it's to Ms. Baker-Olson, but it could be Representative Edelson. So when we created this, when we heard this bill last year, there was no talk of getting rid of the volunteers. So was that part of this assessment process you're in? Where did this come from?
Ms. Baker-Olson.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. This is a new bill. So this bill wasn't heard last year.
So maybe that's where the confusion is. Any comment, Representative Edelson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I believe we had an increase in the guardian ad litem funding for the board last year, and that's what I was referring to. And so that's I think what Representative Robbins is referring to.
Got it. All right. Follow up, Representative Robbins.
Well, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm just too tired, but it's concerning to me that when we passed this new funding last year and we talked about the new FTEs, that there was no discussion that we would be getting rid of the volunteer program. And so I don't know, was that part of the assessment process you're in? Just could you explain to me where this part of the conversation started?
If I may.
Mr. Walker.
We never have indicated at all that we're getting rid of volunteers. As I stated earlier, we're assessing volunteers. We're assessing volunteers as well as staff. We want to make sure that we're effective in our advocacy. Let me point out that over the past year since I've been the manager, we've had lesser volunteers, but we've been more efficient in our delivery of advocacy. We've become more efficient because we are more detailed in our work. We have not given up on volunteers. We're simply assessing them. We're doing what we're mandated to do and required to do. We have worked with CASA Minnesota to expand and allow for them to go beyond just having a case in itself. There are many other factors at play here that goes into much more detail in the role of being an advocate and those who are willing to contribute their time and whether or not they are effective and whether or not they serve the community, you know, and whether or not they're even diverse and whether or not the applicants that Mr. Bodell incited that he have are diverse. It depends. There are many things that go into the role of being an advocate. And yet, here we are. We're assessing. We will have an assessment at some particular time period. We have not given up hope. We continue to train volunteers. We continue to move the process along and allow for us to be the best representation in the 4th Judicial Court. But I'm alarmed. I'm alarmed by the fact that they're only contributing that there seem to be some less advocacy going on in the 2nd and 4th District, which are predominantly people of color. So, you know, again, we're assessing this situation. I'm sorry that individuals, I apologize if individuals see this as much as, you know, a comparison of the two. I've worked with Mr. Bodell very often over the last year, and it has been as transparent as I possibly could be, my program manager and I. I think we're at a point where there's a direction we're going to go, and it does not dismiss volunteers. It's just a different way of how we're going to approach things. And yet, we're being pushed in front of a state legislators to make this as if things should be moving on swiftly here without looking at what we're mandated to do. Now, I just put that before the body.
All right. Respond to Representative Edelson, and then we'll get to your closing.
Madam Chair and members, I absolutely value the guardian ad litem program and the work that Mr. Walker does and Ms. Baker does. This wasn't meant to only target Hennepin and Ramsey initially, but I have not been able to contact the other counties. So I will add them. I will absolutely add them because I haven't confirmed that they're having the exact same problem that I've heard that Hennepin and Ramsey actually is having. And I have to tell you that assessing, it feels like a non-answer. And I appreciate the work that we do and that honestly, it's important work. I've done it and I committed a lot of 4 years of my life to it. I know that Ms. Jones has committed 17 years. If we do not reopen up the volunteer pool, then people drop off, there will be no volunteers. So the assessing will mean that with attrition that it's gone. So I just want us to be honest and have honest conversations. And so I wanted the committee to know what's happening in the state. And so I thank you for having this hearing, Madam Chair.
All Right. And I would just be careful. I don't think anyone's being dishonest. I think there's just a difference of opinion here. And that's fine for us to voice that here. I did screw up the motion at the beginning. This is a motion to, so I will amend my motion to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So thank you for the discussion and testimony today. And with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, members, for another evening, and I will let you all go eat dinner and move on with the rest of your evening. We'll see you Thursday. With that, we are adjourned.